Good evening, everybody. Now, is the microphone on? Y'all being from the South, you can hear me. And my head's not too much in the way because I kind of like to stand and look at people when I talk. Well, I'm very happy to be here tonight. I'm going to talk about meditation research, about some of the pitfalls of trying to research something like meditation. And then I want to talk a little bit about emerging understandings of how the mind and body, or the brain and the body talk to each other that might provide a way of thinking about how something like meditation could have an impact on something as concrete as physical health. Okay? So that's what we're going to do. I'm going to try to talk for about 50 minutes, and then I'm not doing anything else tonight, so I'm happy to stay around and take questions as long as anybody wants. Okay. So I would like to think that it's my international reputation as a speaker and man about town that has filled the room tonight, but I'm almost certain nobody here tonight before this very moment had ever heard of my name at all. And that what was interesting probably was some sort of admixture of the word meditation with inflammation. Maybe consternation. Consternation is also fairly common, but there's such an interest in meditation that it is not an exaggeration to say that there's a gold rush. There really is a mad rush of interest in meditation. Now, I am a very sadly displaced Californian. I've been exiled to the South because of the work I do, sadly. And I chose the California Gold Rush just because I know something about it. And like a gold rush, there's been a huge increase in the use of meditation for all sorts of health interventions in the last 20 years. And in fact, one of the great things about interventions that haven't been studied yet is that they work for everything. And that can be extremely useful, and then when we start studying them, of course, it often doesn't turn out that way. We're sort of in that phase with meditation, and following along, sort of tagging along like a little brother to all the clinical use, has been a very significant increase in research interest in meditation. So you can see all I did, I just went on Medline, and if you look through the decades, you can see that the articles have really gone up almost four times. And this was, you know, early in 2009. There'll be another 100-150 articles this year. It is just crazy how much interest there is. Well, so I'm kind of a second-rate student of California history because I'm so attached to the state. And you know, people back east, when they think about going out to California, and there were hundreds of thousands of people that just stampeded out there, you know, when the gold rush is just starting out, it all looks like this. And certainly in the world of meditation, things are looking very rosy. Unfortunately, though, actually, gold rushes usually end up looking more like this, right? And I suspect that we will find some of the same things as we move forward with meditation research, as we do with all things. If there was a panacea, if there was a solution, if meditation was really the answer to your problems, you'd already be fixed and you'd be meditating like mad tonight, right? And I'm not going to have us put our heads down and hold up our hands, but I would guess that there are probably a percentage of people here that meditate regularly, and I bet there's a much larger percentage of people, myself included, who are great admirers of meditation but don't do it as regularly as we should. So we already know that that meditation is a strange attractor to a very complex and powerful set of emotions at this point in our culture that probably transcends what the technique itself is in terms of what its final practical benefits will be. And we could talk about this all night long. I've gotten really interested in it because of the work I do, and there's some really interesting sort of philosophical issues around thinking about these sorts of things. But the point is that we don't know as much about meditation as we think we do. We certainly don't know as much about meditation as you might think given the hoopla that's surrounded it. If you want to do something behaviorally to improve your health, get up tonight, leave the lecture, and start exercising. And data on exercise are profound, profound. The evidence that regular cardiovascular aerobic exercise has antidepressant properties is striking, right? I mean, meditation is nowhere near the data we have for exercise, okay? So, nonetheless, let's take a look at some of these conclusions from a number of recent meta-analyses done, say, in the last 5 years. So, I won't go through these in details, but you can see here the first one says the results support the safety, potential efficacy, certain illnesses, mood and anxiety. Now, it's kind of an honor to be here because those of you who are in the meditation world probably realize that you are within the geographic nexus of really, this is Meditation Central, right? MBSR really originated up the road a little bit at UMass Amherst, right? I mean, this is kind of holy ground for people that do meditation research. So here is a meta-analysis that says MBSR is able to reduce stress levels in healthy people, and then a very positive meta-analysis about transcendental meditation. Offer clinical cost-effectiveness, advantage in healthcare, great blood pressure, great for African-American kids in the city. But there's also been some meta-analysis that have said this. MBSR does not have a reliable effect on depression and anxiety. There is at present insufficient good quality evidence to conclude whether or not TM has a cumulative positive effect on blood pressure. Look back here, it's just wonderful, potential efficacy, safety. And then the granddaddy of all analytic strategies was this thing that was commissioned by the Department of Health and Human Services to really pull up all 2,500 studies that have been done over meditation and really go through it. It looks at meditation, looks at yoga, and the conclusion is many uncertainties surround the practice of meditation. Firm conclusions on the effect of meditation practices on healthcare cannot be drawn based on the available data, which is really interesting, right? I mean, we think about, you think that the golf ball is already, you know, in the hole, and it's not true. In fact, there's a lot we don't know. And if we go back to those first positive meta-analyses, I kind of cheated on you a little bit because they also said this, clear and reproducible evidence from large, methodologically sound studies is lacking. And the second one said, important limitations, blah, 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 paucity of evidence about possible specific effects in comparison to other treatments. And then in TM, there was a very large meta-analysis done by non-TM practitioners. And they note that whenever the TM people talk, there's never much of a cautionary note, that the meta-analyses are conducted by devotees of TM, and that all the randomized trials have methodological weaknesses that are so biased by the affiliation of the authors to the Maharishi University that we really can't say anything. So it's very interesting that the first thing to say about meditation is that I don't want people to leave here tonight thinking, because I'm going to show you some of our data, that I am presenting this from within a, you know, this is not a house built on a huge, solid, and stable foundation. And what we may know 10 years from now may be very different than what we know now. You know, I had a little brief stint as a Texan back about 1980, right when Urban Cowboy came out. And believe it or not, I actually owned a pair of cowboy boots and a hat, and I used to every once in a while country western dance. I've had a strange life. And there was a time there, and most of you, some of you folks are too young to remember this, but there was a time when all sorts of people were sort of into this, and then American ADHD blew on, the winds of change came, and nobody in this room, country western dance is probably a two-step, probably not a big deal anymore, right? So the point is that things like meditation have their ups and their downs, and right now, those of us who are studying this are sort of riding this big wave, but there's a number of problems that if they are not addressed, are going to sink the field. So maybe one of the things that tonight will kick up for us is the fact, and we'll talk a little bit about how do we think about study design. So let's talk about that for a second. So I'm going to talk about this first line in the next slide, I think. But here are some of the other the unanswered questions. How about this for a humdinger? Well, what does meditation do? Right? So suppose I said, hey, I've got a pill that's just great for depression. And you very wisely say, well, what's in the pill? And I said, I don't know. Well, what kind of pill is it? Well, I don't know. It's like there's 10 pills, actually, or 15. I don't know. Here, you want it? Well, which one is it? Well, I don't know. Somebody gave it to me. Right? You'd have to be pretty darn depressed, right? And yet, that is very much the situation with meditation, especially in terms of scientific research. Do different practices have different effects? Who knows? How long do you need to train for it, right? We did, as you'll see, a six-week study. Now, why did we do 6 weeks? Did Buddha indicate that 6 weeks was a good time for health improvement? No. We built it into a PE class at Emory, and 6 weeks was all we had, right? We had 5 weeks, we worked on a five-week study, right? So, 6 weeks, 6 years, 6 months, what do we want? Right? And the meditation teachers themselves don't know.
Do you need 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day, 20 minutes a day? How does meditation work? Does it work through by components specific to meditation or through more general therapeutic actions? You'd feel better too if you were in a meditation class and thought, wow, man, damn, I'm so cool. And I'm sitting with all these people and I'm going to change my life and I'm going to give up all the drinking and drugs because I'm in a meditation class. And somebody's actually listening to me. These can be very powerful effects for all sorts of illnesses. How important is the amount of practice to outcomes? Right? So is it enough just to go to the class? Maybe hearing is believing, right? Maybe she's going to hear something in this class that is so outrageous that it changed her life. It's got nothing to do with the practice time, right? As I'll talk about in our studies of college freshmen with compassion meditation, one of the things that we told them was that, you know, if they don't like somebody, maybe it's not altogether the result of that person. Maybe it has something to do with them. Man, some of these people could knock them over with a feather. They never had that thought in their entire life. No, the guy's just a jerk. What are you talking about? So maybe that kind of knowledge is what does the trick. So do you need to practice? How much do you need to practice? Who knows, right? Well, for which diseases would it work best? What are the spiritual underpinnings and how important are they? If I'm going to teach her meditation, but let's say I don't think that she knows a lot of, she doesn't believe in reincarnation, so I've got to take the reincarnation out. Now, have I just vitiated the practice? We don't know. There's actually studies suggesting that people that have more of a spiritual context for a meditation practice get bigger physiologic benefits. So we don't know that either. And you know, we know in the Western world that as your plane is starting to crash, everybody starts calling on God at that moment, right? Now, some of us call on him in various ways, but as the plane's going down, that's you're kind of a day late and a dollar short, right? I mean, whereas if you've been religious all your life, I actually was, many years ago, dating a very religious woman, and the plane started having a little bit of trouble. And I was just sweating bullets. She was like totally calm, right? Because she thought she was going to heaven. I thought I was going to limbo, right? And so this is a very, maybe meditation would be better as a preventive strategy, right? Then maybe when you're really sick and feeling horrible, maybe that's not the time to try to get on a meditation pill, right? We don't know. Almost all the studies done have been as a treatment. There's only one line of research that looks at meditation as preventive, and this is a secondary preventive strategy, and I'll show you those data in a couple of slides. So I hope this outlines the fact that we don't have the slightest idea in many ways what we're talking about, right? Which is always a nice way to start a lecture, just to clear the air about this thing. So I've got the words meditation, inflammation, consternation in the title. Let me talk about each of those words. So let's start with meditation. What is meditation? And as I said, this is not such an easy thing to answer. And one of the interesting developments within our little field is that there's a movement amongst sort of scholars of meditation to point out that we in the West have had this very idealistic, casual, sloppy, black box view of meditation. You know, find me a meditation teacher, and that's meditation, right? And that's it. So, but is that really meditation? Well, it turns out that there's all sorts of different practices, and within sort of, at least, and I have to beg ignorance of all but Buddhist world, but let's just, you know, in the Buddhist world alone, there's all these different types of practices, and they have very different purposes within the traditional understanding, right? And from a Western point of view, although I can't totally prove this to you, there's pretty good data to suggest that some meditation practices relax the body and mind, and those are almost all the ones that have been studied scientifically. Others probably activate the stress system. So there are some types of meditation that increase heart rate, increase ventilation. They're more like exercise than they are like relaxing. And then some of them are visualization practices, which again are altogether different. And tonight we'll talk a little bit about what in the Tibetan Buddhist world are often called analytic practices, which are extremely different, as we'll talk about, than just sort of trying to focus on your breath or trying to be very mindful of what's going on without passing judgment. These are practices that are full of thoughts, they're full of judgments, they're full of normative values, they're more like internal cognitive behavioral therapy in many ways, at least some of them, right? So the point is that there is no such thing as meditation any more than there's such a thing as a Smith College student. Well, there is a Smith College student, but you might imagine that picking one or the other might produce very different results. And the same thing is very true for meditation. So you can see that this is a real problem, and that when somebody talks about a meditation study, you might want to say, what type of meditation. But then if they're really smart, they'll say to you, well, what's the evidence that there's any difference between them? To which you'll have to say, I don't know, not much, actually, to be honest with you. A little bitty bit, but not much. Right? So, now, having been Mr. Gloomy Gus and Mr. Rain on the Parade, let me talk a little bit about some of the data streams that have gotten people's interest so ramped up about all this, and let's talk a little bit about the flaws in the data or the designs too. So, here are figures from three different studies which all have essentially the same design, which is you give me a bunch of people that have been meditating like crazy dogs for years and years and years, and I'm going to match them, age and sex, to a bunch of people who don't meditate, and I'm going to study their brains. I'm going to either look at the size of their brain, especially cortical areas, or over on the left, Antoine Lutz's work, I'm going to look at the way brain regions are connected with each other. And when they do these studies, they find that people that have been meditating for years tend to have these very encouraging differences in their brain. So for instance, they tend to have thicker cortical areas, areas of the prefrontal cortex, area like the hippocampus. Now, so what's up with the sort of thick, who cares about thickness in those areas? Well, we know that stress shrinks those areas. We know that depression is associated with shrinkage in those areas. We know that they're the first areas usually to go down the toilet with a number of dimensions, right? So the idea that, people that meditate have sort of thickened in these areas suggests maybe there's something about meditation that may be neuroprotective. We know that especially in animal studies, you give animals antidepressants and you know, up thickens these areas, you know, dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, hippocampus, anterior cingulate, for those of you that are neuroscience folks in the crowd, right? So it's very intriguing, but I bet if you think about it for a second, one might think about some problems, right? So can I see a show of hands for everybody in this room who spent more than 3 years meditating 12 hours a day? Yeah, okay, so we're all a bunch of lightweights, right? So, now, if this was a Tibetan audience, there would be more people, but you know, there wouldn't be that many more people, actually, to tell you the truth. And it suggests that, many are called and few are chosen. Maybe it's not that easy to really meditate for all those years. Maybe certain kinds of brains are the types of brains that are able to do it. Maybe those are the kinds of brains that are thicker in those cortical regions, so they're able to meditate more. You see what I mean? So, maybe if you meditate for years and years, it thickens up your cortex. Or maybe if you're sort of born with these brain opportunities, you are able to meditate more. Does everybody understand? You'll see with my own data, this is a thing, you'll see. I'm guilty of my own critique here, and you'll see what we've tried to do to begin to address it. So how would you address this? Well, you'd have to get a whole bunch of people that were really committed to entering years of long-term meditation, and you'd have to get a scan beforehand, right? And then you'd have to keep, well, even if you just got a scan beforehand, but then you'd have to keep half of them from meditating. That's the problem, right? Because what are you going to compare them to? If the idea is that maybe people who want to do this have different brains to start with, you'd have to keep half of them from doing it. So you can see it's a problem. But there are people that are trying to do this now, much to their credit. Alan Wallace, a buddy of ours who's out in California, has got this thing where people are studying meditating 12 hours a day for a couple of years now. And they're really, at least they're looking at them before and after, right? Because if you could show that your brain, you know, your hippocampus is this size on day one, and 4 years later it's this size, and you've been meditating 12 hours a day, well, most people's hippocampus don't have hippocampi, don't do that. So that's pretty good, right? It's better than a cross-sectional assessment. But having said that, these are very intriguing findings, and it's just as likely that meditation does increase brain matter, right? We know that guys that juggle will get increases in areas of the brain dealing with hand-eye coordination. So it's not, there's nothing mystical about it, and it's very encouraging and it's very interesting. It suggests certainly the people that give their lives to serious meditation, it may have brain effects that are very relevant to health. Now here is a study that is more, that's got a little bit of a stronger design, and it's a very well-known study done by Richard Davidson's group in Wisconsin. So we took a bunch of people in a business, I think it was a computer software firm, excuse me, who had never meditated, flipped a coin. So if everybody that wanted to meditate, half got, we'll put on a wait list. We'll teach you meditation later. And the other half got 8 weeks MBSR. And he did a couple of things, but one of the things he did was he, after they were finished with the training, he gave everybody a flu shot. And he looked to see whether the people in the meditation group had more of an antibody response than the people that were just told to hang out and do nothing. And you can see that indeed, they did have more of an antibody response. Now, the reason that this was in psychosomatic medicine instead of New England Journal of Medicine was that when they looked within the meditation group, practice time had no effect whatsoever. So there were people like her, she just came to class and that was it. She didn't do anything else. And there were people like her, she meditated 2 hours every day and there was no difference. Zero. So it sort of suggests that maybe it wasn't the meditation exactly. Maybe it was something else. Maybe it was the information. Maybe it was the camaraderie, right? Now, that's not to say that it's not valuable, but there's other ways of getting information, other ways of getting camaraderie. If it was really just the information, maybe I could just give you a seminar. You could forget all that, dang, you know, it's hard work to meditate every day, right? Nuts to that, maybe it's just the information that she needs. Right? It could have spared her a lot of time and trouble. We were talking tonight at dinner that the Dalai Lama had told somebody, Mary, I can't remember who it was, but that at a science meeting, that if scientists could really invent a pill that would cause genuine enlightenment, he would take it immediately. Nuts. This guy meditates 6 hours a day, right? Nuts to that. I mean, the goal is enlightenment. There's nothing magic about the practice. So these are very interesting, important questions. So how do you think about this? You think, well, there's something here that's worth exploring, and it's very interesting, but it's not altogether straightforward because there's not an effect of practice time. Now, here, I think, are the strongest clinical data that I know of in terms of meditation. And this is the work that was started by John Teasdale, Mark Williams, and Zindel Siegel, looking at something they call MBCT. Have you all heard of this? Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So, you know, cognitive therapy, if you think about it, is, you know, she's depressed, I'm a therapist, and it's more complicated than this. But basically, you know, I point out to her that she's got all these thoughts. I'm such a loser. Nobody likes me. I'm never going to get a boyfriend. How do you know that? How do you know that? And the therapist, and then you got to do this homework, right? What's interesting is that there's, you know, so there's a little bit of condemnation there. It's very effective, but, you know, you got to challenge these bad thoughts of yours, you know. But the danger is if you're really depressed, you might start going, oh man, I'm such a loser for having these bad thoughts, you know? Oh, and then I'm such a loser for thinking I'm such a loser that I had these bad thoughts. So what these guys realized was that one of the things that sets people up for relapse, so if you're depressed, it gets you well with antidepressants or psychotherapy, whatever, if you are saying, hey, you know, I'm all right, you're a lot less likely to have a relapse than if everything that happens, you're all guilty and thinking, oh, like that. And so they realized that one of the things that might help depressed people was to bring in a mindfulness element, where instead of always being active, the throat of your thoughts, you just observe them. And instead of buying into your thoughts, you see them as thoughts. Maybe that would break the power of these negative cognitive patterns that set people up for relapse. So they combine mindfulness, MBSR, with cognitive behavioral therapy. And they've done a number of studies. Now, what this shows, for instance, is that if you take people who were depressed, and now they're not depressed, and you follow them for a year or so, and half of them get this MBCT, and half of them just sort of get usual treatment, that the treatment as usual people, 80% of them relapse within a year. And that's not out of the realm of normal. Depression is a talk for another night. Depression is a terrible, terrible disorder. Whereas the people that got the addition of the MBCT, only, and I say only in quotes, 35-40% relapsed. Now, there's no doubt that this is hugely different from each other. Now, see, this is a large effect size. Here's a smaller effect size. But what's interesting is that these are people that were depressed and are well, and so half of them get MBCT and half of them get antidepressants. And what they found was that overall, the people with MBCT did better than the people with antidepressants. But it's not that simple, because these people all started on antidepressants, and only about half of them were able to get off the antidepressants. Right? But what it suggests, but it's very powerful, I think, it suggests that you to keep the thing from blowing a fuse, you either need an antidepressant, or if you can get this other thing on top of it, ease it in, then you might be able to get rid of the antidepressant. So I think this is very, very promising work. Now, there's other people who have been doing this study, I think, with a poor design, where they took a bunch of people that had been made well with an antidepressant, flipped the coin, half of them stayed on the antidepressant, and half of them just stopped the antidepressant immediately and started to MBCT. And almost all of them immediately relapsed. Right? because you can't just do that, right? These guys, it's a much more realistic design. That points to the fact that, you know, none of these things are magic bullets or magic, like, nothing works perfectly. But I do think that this is a very promising technique. It's being done in very, very rigorous studies. And if you ask me, what do I think is the most compelling data out there right now, I would say that. There are less well-organized studies that suggest that things like MBSR are probably also useful, I've just highlighted here, for people that are sick. Sometimes helping symptoms. So it was here at Amherst that, Jon Kabat-Zinn showed that MBSR reduced skin problems and psoriasis. There's studies showing that people that have pain, their pain can decrease. Excuse me, something short time. And then, but here's, I think an Indian food coming. Here's another. I talk about 100 times a year, this has never happened. Cognitive behavioral therapy versus MBSR, for social anxiety disorder, they both work. But the CBT worked better. There's a couple of studies that sort of suggest that there's a CBT MBSR study in arthritis that sort of shows the same thing. So this is something else to think about, right? So I'm being kind of a gloomy Gus here, but the point is that for those of you who are clinicians in the audience, I think meditation has huge potential. Many people are benefited by it. But the data at this point don't suggest that we should sort of toss out everything else we're doing and just in a sort of simple, unitary way embrace something like this as the answer to all of our troubles. Although, as I say, there are these promising data. Now, I just caused everybody to look. I should go up. I can't look at this picture because I have two little kids. But I, if you were asleep, I hope you're awake. It's something well worth thinking about. So let's talk about consternation. I want to talk about that for a second too, because this is, although not directly related to meditation, what I really do for a day job is study how do the mind and body talk to each other to make people exhausted, miserable, and sick. And what we are learning is that what science is saying is very different than what diagnostic books and psychiatrists say. And that is that when we talk about, if we think about emotional conditions for which we might want to apply meditation, so when we talk about consternation, unhappiness, depression, anxiety, we're not really talking about discrete illnesses. We're talking about symptom clusters that tend to get spun off probabilistically from certain very stereotyped alterations in the brain and body. We'll talk a little bit about. So I just wanted to say that as we think about this, that when I talk about these practices being useful for emotional well-being, I'm really talking about the fact that almost, all the anxieties and unhappinesses and being too happy and being too agitated and having a weakness for drugs and alcohol, all these things, they share genes, they share pathways in the brain, they share pathways in the body, and there is evidence that, such as it is, that meditation is probably useful for all, okay? Now, every time I put the slide up, it goes into this weird wingy game things here. You can see I'm having a stressor night here. So this is supposed to say, what is inflammation? So now look at that. Only people that have done meditation for 12 hours a day for at least 3 years understand this language. There's like a little devil in my computer. So what is inflammation? Well, this is inflammation happening in front of your eyes. This is an electron micrograph of a macrophage, of a primary, one of the cells that patrols the body looking for foreigners, or foreigners, as we'd say, perhaps down in Georgia. And it's been caught in the act of spotting such a foreigner. Here's a bacteria. And it's sent out a pseudopod. It's going to swallow that bacteria. And that's what really starts inflammation. Let me walk you through sort of a comic book version of what I mean by inflammation. Since I have it in the title, it must be important. And I want to suggest to you that probably all systems in the body and brain is emerging as maybe primary as a promoter of illness in the 21st century. So here's a bunch of different bodily organs. Most of us, when we think about inflammation, you know it's got something to do with sickness, something to do with, you know, invading pathogens. So here's a bacteria. And it turns out that your body has two types of immunity. It's got something called innate immunity, which is very, very rapid and very nonspecific. And then there's another type of immunity called acquired specific immunity, and that's the antibodies, the T cells, and it takes a long time to develop, and it's very, very specific for things that are on the surface of bacteria and viruses, and sometimes on tumor cells, right? So you've got one type of immune system that's like a redneck with a shotgun, right? It doesn't like foreign people very much. If it's got a weird sense there's somebody foreign back there, it just pulls out the old shotgun and fires. Now, usually, you know, if there really are foreigners back there and they're really dangerous, then it's a good deal because you take out the foreigner, of course you wipe out a quarter of the room, but the rest of you guys, if you can ignore the blood and the gore, can listen to the lecture, right? Whereas if the foreigner really has a gun or a bomb or something, we're all finished, right? It's fast, it's dirty, it's cheap, and evolution has held on to it because it's such a dangerous world that the trade-off is for most of human history and for most species, it's a fair trade-off. The other type of immunity is why, you know, when you get the flu, about 5-6 days later, you kind of get over it, and you go, wow, I feel better. Well, what's happened? That it takes that much time and that much energy for your body to produce these antibodies and specific T cells. That's more like a highly trained sniper, right, that is so expert at recognizing what makes something foreign that, right, and it goes right through the head of the person. And, you know, you guys keep listening to the lecture. The person would be like this, you wouldn't even know they were shot, right? It's that specific, but it takes a long time. And it's very expensive. So the first thing that happens when your body sees something foreign is it's time for the redneck of the shotgun. And your body has all sorts of ways of getting a sense there's something that it's not me. It's dangerous and it's not me. And when that happens, it activates these kind of cells, these macrophages, dendritic cells. They're all around at the surface of your body. Anywhere where you're vulnerable to be breached, these cells are always sampling. And when they detect something foreign, they activate. And when they activate, they begin to produce all these chemicals called cytokines. Now, you don't need to remember all this, but I just would like you to remember, especially this one, IL-6. Just remember this as being a chemical that floats around in the blood and gets up into the brain and makes you sick. It's really what activates inflammation. So when these chemicals get made at the site of invasion, they cause classic, what we used to think of when I was a kid, in medical school, as inflammation, hot, red, painful, swollen, right? Which makes a lot of sense. If I get a splinter and I don't pull it out, you know, my body knows there's something bad there and it tries to destroy it, right? So it calls in all these immune cells and they fire off all these really hot chemicals. They're just trying to bomb the hell out of the thing so they can kill it before it spreads, right? So that is what inflammation does locally. But inflammation always also goes down to the liver. And the liver makes most of the proteins that float around in our blood. And basically, it tells the liver, look, forget about what you do on a daily basis. You know, you're going to die if you don't completely change and produce all these chemicals to help us fight the infection. We need to turn this on and turn that off. So it produces a lot of inflammatory and anti-inflammatory chemicals. And then for our talk tonight, the other thing we now know about inflammation is that all these cytokines get up into the head. And this is what makes you sick. So if she gets the flu virus fever and chill and she aches, she doesn't want to come to the lecture, that's not the virus that's doing that. That's her body. Her body does that, and it has been doing that for millions of years, highly adapted, highly evolved trait to help you kill viruses, right? Because everything about being sick is designed to make your body an inhospitable place for bacteria and viruses and parasites, right? It doesn't always work, and sometimes the sickness itself is what kills you, but that's why it exists. Fever exists because viruses and bacteria fall apart at temperatures above 98.6. People are anemic when they're sick for a long time because bacteria especially need iron, and if you starve them of their iron, they're not as likely to survive. You replace iron in people that are chronically sick, and sometimes they die because all of a sudden the bacteria go wild. Right? So all sorts of things that happen in your body, fatigue, exhaustion, losing interest in things, that can be happen when these cytokines get into your brain, are what your body do. And all this is designed to help you fight infection. Now, what we have learned as a field in the last 10 or 15 years, however, is that all of this is very much involved with sickness, right? It's all what happens when you get the flu. It's what happens when you get a big old horrible something where you rip up your skin and you get a fever and stuff. Is also caused every time we're put under psychological stress. So, stress and sickness physiologically are remarkably similar to each other. And whether I inject her with a bunch of bacteria or just really shame her, in fact, if I look at her body and even her brain, very hard to tell the difference. Right? So psychological stress, in the modern world at least, activates exactly the same inflammatory circuits as are activated by cancer cells, by tissue damage, by bacteria, by viruses. Now, how do we know that psychological stress activates inflammation? Well, there's all sorts of studies showing that, in fact, if you look at people and ask them how stressed they are, and they say, yay, and you look, the more stressed they are, the more their inflammation goes up, right? But we can do you one better. I can actually prove to you that inflammation, that stress turns on inflammation. And it's no more complicated than this picture. So this is what I spend the other part of my life doing, sort of torturing people. This is a thing called the Trier Social Stress Test. So we take somebody like her. She knows she's in a research experiment, but she doesn't really know what's going on. We've got an IV in her arm. We're drawing her blood. We're measuring her heart rate. She's sitting in a hospital room. And then, you know, I come in and I say, okay, you gotta go now. We put her in a wheelchair. And I wheel her into this room. And she sees three people staring at her, wearing white coats, just staring at her. And she sees a camera and a microphone. And I say, stand up behind the microphone, please. And I say, your task today is to so you've told us you're interested in going to medical school. Your task today is to prepare a speech that would essentially describe to this panel why you'd be a good applicant for medical school. Now, the panel are behavioral experts trained in the analysis of human behavior, but try not to let that bother you. Your speech will be recorded for later behavioral analysis, but try to ignore that. Once the speech is finished, we'll have another task for you that they'll explain at that time. Any questions? And usually people say no. And we give them 10 minutes and take notes, but they can't use their notes, right? So we draw some more blood, they sit down, they take the notes, the panel sort of storms out. Then 10 minutes later, the panel comes back in. The guy in the middle says, stand up behind the microphone, state your patient. She says, start. Well, you know, I did pretty well in school. And usually people get about 3 minutes into it, and they sort of go, that's it. So the guy in the middle is kind of stopped. 20 seconds. Stares him down. The end of 20 seconds says something like, please continue, you have more time. You know? If on the other hand, the person is too glib and going on and on and on, they'll say something like, stop, are you always this glib? Something like that. So you just kind of kneel. At the end of 5 minutes, the chairman says, stop. We have another task for you. We want you to take the number 1,187, subtract 13 down to zero as rapidly and as accurately as possible. Please start. 1,187. First mistake, you go stop. 1,187. Stop. 1,187. Please concentrate. You're making too many mistakes. Person starts counting out loud. You go stop. Count in your head. 1,187. People use their fingers. You go, put your hands down. Stop. 1,187. So now we put the microphone near the wall because young people have very reactive autonomic nervous systems, and every time we do it, out of every 30 people, at least one will pass out. We've been lucky so far. We get panic attacks, spontaneous crying. Now, I also study people, I study old codgers who have hepatitis C, and they tend to be a little crusty around the edges. And especially the guys, a couple of them have actually gone after the dude in the center. I mean, we put them up there and tell them jokes and work with them just to try to make sure that they, all they gotta do is smile once and all the stress response goes away. There's studies showing this, it's unbelievable. In fact, they've shown that if you take married couples and you put a husband up to this and you put his wife in the room kind of looking at him, his stress responses go down like crazy, right? Now, on the other hand, if you put the wife up there and make her do the task, the husband in the room, she gets more of a blood pressure. Go figure. But what this very reliably, up goes heart rate, up goes blood pressure, up goes cortisol, which is the big stress hormone. This is a real stressor. Human beings are programmed to
to respond to this sort of neutral, mildly antagonizing, slightly shameful exposure with as a real danger. And we could talk all night, and I will talk in a second about why this is a potent danger. But it's like I say, this is the classic way to activate stress, okay? So this is a major stressor. Almost everybody will have stress system activation. So here's what this diagram says. Here's the time period before that stressful task. Here's the time period of that task. We're going to look for 90 minutes afterwards, and we're going to measure inflammation in the blood, that IL-6 business, right? So we're going to watch and see if the stressor makes it go up. So let's start with men who are about 30 years old on average. They're medically healthy. They don't have any depression. And voila, here's my proof to you. They come in with IL-6 here, and they go out with it significantly higher. So there's no doubt that if I just took people in this room and made you do what I'm doing now and you weren't ready to do it, and I frowned at you a lot and asked you questions and hassled you, which you're being nice enough not to do to me, that I can show you that it drives up this inflammation. But now, what if you took a group of men the same age, also medically healthy, so they don't have any sickness, but what if you just took some guys that are depressed? What would that do to their inflammatory responses to stress? Well, this is really quite remarkable, because first off, these guys come in the door, their inflammation's already higher, and there are at least 200 studies now showing that you just give me a group of people here whose depression score is 20, and a group of people here whose depression score is 2, and everybody's healthy, they're all the same age, same weight, same smoking, you guys have got inflammatory markers here, you guys have inflammatory markers there. Right? There's some people over here that are higher than some people over there, but on average, it's very striking, it's been shown over and over again. Here it is again, these guys come in the door. But then, after a little bit of a lag, they take off like gangbusters. Now, we've subsequently looked out here for 5 or 6, 7 hours. We can't see any time that it comes down. Really remarkable. So you ask, how could a little stressor, you know, lead to such health problems, right? You know, because heart rate goes like this. Cortisol goes like this. These guys just go like this. So what this suggests, and I took out all these slides because I knew I was going to run out of time, which I probably am. But it turns out that the stress system changes that are common in people that are depressed all conspire to jack up inflammation. So that if you're depressed, you're wandering around the world responding to fairly minor psychosocial challenges as if they're massive bacterial assaults. Right? Now, so what? So who cares? Well, the so what is that we now know that essentially every illness that kills people primarily in the developed world is mostly mediated by inflammation. If I said that 10 years ago, people would say, oh, man, you're pushing it. And nowadays, it's not true. So basically, if I took this room, again, you're all healthy. I can do this tonight. And I'm going to measure one marker of inflammation, something simple like CRP, or maybe this IL-6 business. You're all normal. And I make you change seats. So this side is the top side of normal. You guys are the top half. You guys are in the bottom half. I'm going to follow you for 5 years. You've got these guys. Everybody's normal. Everybody's healthy. You're middle-aged. The people that are in the top half of inflammation, all normal, have about a 500% increased risk of having a heart attack or stroke. They've got a 500-600% increased risk of developing diabetes. They've got an increased risk of getting fatigued and depressed. Right? If you are sick and your inflammation's up, you're going to die. Right? So we know that inflammatory processes are directly involved with diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia, and as I've said, depression. So what's up with this? So here is a simple way to think about illness in our time, in our place. For eons, almost every organism, every mammal, has either died of being eaten or infection. And until the last 70, 80 years, 90 years, almost every human being died of infection. Most people, especially since the rise of agriculture 10,000 years ago, have died of infection. Most people died, people lived to 40, often lived to 60 or 80. Most people are dropping off in childhood or, you know, teens or 20s. So there's been huge selective pressure to have that redneck of the shotgun really have a hair trigger because there's so many dangers, right? Now, all of a sudden, you come into the modern world and you start getting flush toilets. You know, the year they put sewage systems into New York City, which I think was either 1902 or 1903, the death rate's like about in half in 1 year. Right? So sanitation, sewage, antibiotics, hospitals, public health, most of us are not going to die of infection anymore, problem, unless there's some kind of horrible thing that sweeps through.
But for the last generation, most people haven't died of infection. This is very rare, and yet we're still left with these systems that have evolved and that are looking for something to shoot at. So what do they shoot at? Well, they're shooting at you know, when your boyfriend breaks up with you, they're shooting at you. When you get a bee, Smithies, they're shooting at you. Over time, those chemicals that are released again and again and again cause your brain to go into states that make you depressed, cause damage to your coronary vasculature. In fact, we know that most people have coronary artery disease when they actually have a heart attack. The heart attack is driven by this huge surge of local inflammation. They damage your brain, so you get Alzheimer's. They cause you to be insulin resistant, so you get diabetes. Right? So we know that there's so many factors in modern world that conspire to drive needless inflammation. And inflammation leads to things like oxidative stress, and the bottom line is it's all wear and tear. Most people today die of wear and tear. And if you look at disorders like depression, they're really disorders of premature aging. And if you look at the effect of psychological stress on this thing called telomere length, which is sort of a measure for the age of yourself, the more stressed you are, the more they're eating away, right? So, you know, the more that you just sort of keep activating all these hot chemicals in your body, they're fairly worthless. I'm pretty convinced that there is no advantage of dumping all that IL-6 in response to my silly little TST test, right? But we know that every time your IL-6 is up day in, day out, day in, day out, that it sets you up for problems, right? And so, you know, if I take a big old, rip out a bunch of her tissue, not only does it totally disrupt the lecture, but everybody goes, oh my God, get her to the hospital, right? If on the other hand, I'm just picking on you because you're sitting here, let me just like this, not a problem. What if I do this for 15 years? She's gonna have a giant gaping wound there, right? That is what inflammation is, right? Just day in, day out, that little extra, every time somebody smiles at you, every time something doesn't go your way. So we know that it's really important that if there was some strategy, some way of reducing these inflammatory responses to stress, it would certainly help with depression and probably help with all these other illnesses. But what strategy? A little bonobos. Well, there's all sorts of strategies. Exercise reduces it, eating right reduces it, sleeping right reduces it. But we are extremely interested in particular in psychosocial strategies, because as it turns out, and I don't have time to go into this quite as much as I wish I could, but it really appears that if you have very positive psychosocial activity, if you live in a world of win-win, a world of mutual cooperation, a world where differences are solved by adaptive, constructive dialogue rather than name-calling and isolation and collapse, that to the degree that you do that, your inflammation is decreased. Which sort of makes sense, right? If your brain thinks it lives in a world that's safe, in a world that somebody's got its back, it signals the body, hey, you know, send a redneck to bed. You don't need all this danger system activity, and you don't need all this inflammation. And indeed, these are two studies that just show that if you look at people that are socially integrated versus people that are socially isolated and lonely, even people feel, it's really that feeling of being lonely that seems to be especially bad. Loneliness is associated with increased inflammation, decreased anti-inflammation. Being socially integrated, having positive psychosocial connectivity, the opposite, tends to promote anti-inflammatory activity and suppress all this inflammation. So, what if there was a strategy to do this, it should reduce inflammation. But the question is, of course, which strategy, which is directly related to the question, and all of a sudden we're back to meditation. Why do we study compassion meditation at Emory? And, of course, this is one reason. This is the other reason, really. My collaborator, Geshe Lunsang, who developed all the meditation stuff, you wouldn't want me to teach you meditation. You wouldn't want him to measure cytokines either. But, so we got a nice relationship. But I know something about Tibetan Buddhism. I've been interested in it for years. And I know that they have the most radical program I know of for changing, for rearranging one's perceived sense of the psychosocial surrounding. And it really is this whole compassion meditation. This is a quote from the Dalai Lama, basically saying that you can't learn patience and tolerance from a friend. They really can be practiced only when you come in contact with an enemy or somebody that's unpleasant. So the basic essence of this compassion meditation is to train yourself to spontaneously recognize danger as being a benefit. Psychosocial danger as being a benefit. And so I convinced Geshe Lobsang, who didn't take much convincing, that we should study this type of meditation, because I was convinced that if people could rearrange how they saw the social surroundings, to see it as a place of opportunity and benefit and not as a place of conflict and danger, that it would lower inflammatory responses to psychosocial stress. So, here's one of those little wing dings. It's supposed to say, what is compassion meditation? Let me start talking about it by talking about the guy that's sort of credited with bringing it to, what time is it, by the way?
25
minutes. Ooh, I've got to really hurry. Okay. I'm trying to debate whether to tell you the story or not. It's a pretty good story. Okay. Well, do you mind if I go over a little bit? Okay. All right. So Atisha, who brought, Atisha was a scholar who in his middle age realized that all the books were like dry dust and he needed to really to practice the techniques. So he became the world's greatest meditator. He really became sort of a meditation master at this place called Nalanda, the great Buddhist university of early medieval India. And there he was, and he got a request to go to Tibet, because Tibet had been exposed to Buddhism about 300 years earlier, but it died out. Didn't want to go. Eventually, certain signs and omens convinced him he had to go. So he agreed to go to Tibet, and then just as he was getting ready to go, he learned something that brought him to despair, complete despair, something that made him realize that his life's work was going to be wasted and lost if he went to Tibet. He really became almost suicidal, that all this effort, that the effort of countless lifetimes was going to be squandered if he did this. And what he learned about Tibet that made him feel this way was that they were all nice and agreeable people. Very friendly, very easygoing, wanted to help him out. And this drove him to total despair because he knew if he moved there that he would not be able to continue his practice and he would lose all that he'd been working for. And so finally, how he got out of his despair was to remedy the situation. He scoured around Bengal until he found the most obnoxious, idiotic, arrogant, narcissistic, spoiled, selfish, critical, whiny little jerk that he could find. And he made this guy his tea server. Now, tea servers spend 24 hours a day in the most intimate of surroundings with the master, right? So basically, he took the most unpleasant person imaginable and assured that person was with him constantly, the closest range possible, 24 hours a day for the rest of his life. And with that, he went extremely happily to Tibet because he knew that his future was secure and he could continue his practice. So that gives you a flavor of compassion meditation. It's really built around what I here call two redirections. And the first, so it's got two phases. And the first is this idea of developing equanimity. And you can see there's a couple of quotes here. Understand your attachments, your aversions, and your indifference, love them all. And just an example about, this is from Shantideva, you know, if you befriend an enemy, he becomes your friend. If you fall out with a friend, he becomes an enemy. That these are really impermanent ideas. Well, the way that this is, that they instantiate this is, you know, at the basis of the Buddhist worldview is this idea that samsaric existence, the world we're in, is driven by three mental poisons. Ignorance, attachment, and aversion, often pictured as a pig, a cock, a rooster, and a snake swallowing each other's tail in this endless cycle of futility. And the first part of compassion meditation is, so we think about meditation as being something where, you know, you just clear your mind, or you try to focus on a candle, or you become really mindful, like you can hear the projector sound. That is a very powerful part of meditation, but this is really different. You take meditative concentration and you think about ideas. And the classic idea you think about in a Tibetan Buddhist version of compassion meditation is, if reincarnation is true, and we've been reincarnated innumerable times, in innumerable worlds, it means that we have stood in every possible relationship with every possible being, not just once, but every time, innumerable times. So there have been unnumbered measures of time when he's been my little baby. And there's been unmeasured times when I've been his little baby, right? So the guy that I'm killing today, in another lifetime, I would have laid my life down for, same consciousness. So because of that, you know, you think about this, it really starts messing with your mind, actually, you know. And if reincarnation is true, I think this is, it's like Nietzsche's eternal recurrence. I think it is an inescapable outcome of that, and it absolutely proves the fact that all of your, no matter how real your attachments and aversions seem, they're absolutely adventitious, and that essentially you are not seeing reality at all correctly. Well, fortunately, we don't need to invoke reincarnation to prove that we have been honed by evolution. Evolution recognizes these same three primary things, right? Attachment means I'm going to eat you or have sex with you. Aversion means you're going to eat me or, you know, I've got to run from you. And ignorance means I do not recognize you as a source of either benefit or danger. So you see, life, a definition of life is that which can approach, sources of reproduction and survival, retreat from sources of danger to that agenda, and ignore the rest. Right? That is samsaric life. So Buddhism and science, here, their conceptualizations overlap very nicely. But we know that, in fact, even this one lifetime, I just do a mental test. Think about if you've ever been really in love with somebody and it really didn't work out. And certainly, I'm not the only person in the room that's had that problem, right? Think about how, oh my God, when I'm thinking about her right now, oh, she's so perfect. God, man, I got to know her. Oh, what a drag, right? If my feelings were true, right, if my perception was right, right? Clearly, you know, or you know, you think about the fact that if you're young and you're not married tonight, right, and you're not going to marry the person that you're going out with, the person you're going to spend your life with, you haven't met yet. You'd walk right by them. You'd ignore them. You wouldn't even think they're anybody. And yet they're going to become the most important person to you. So how many of the people you ignore are going to be, in fact, the linchpins of your future, right? So it's very clear that our perception is flawed. And so you spend a fair amount of time, first intellectually, and then hopefully more spontaneously, recognizing that although you have these emotions about people, they don't reflect reality. Here's my naughty picture, a little weenie picture. Now, the near enemy, you can imagine if you became like that, you might just become like a zombie, right? Hey, you know, I don't really love you, I don't really hate you, I don't really want to ignore you, I'm just like, that is a terrible, terrible flaw in this, you know, because what the equanimity is for is then to develop this passionate desire to aid suffering beings. And one of the interesting things about Tibetan Buddhism is it's very body focused, and there's a little bit of tantra in compassion meditation, which is why I put up the little guy with his 72,000 channels, which is that the next step, after you've developed this equanimity, is to begin working with somebody you have spontaneous empathy with, right? So your sweet little baby boy, or your mom. Traditionally, it's your mom. Now, in the West, that's problematic, right? So you can't often go there. But, you know, somebody that you really feel like if something bad happened, you'd be devastated, right? And the practice, you meditate on this, you think about this, and then you try to generate a profound desire to do whatever you can to help that person not suffer. And then we have people work on that for themselves, because Westerners often have trouble with self-esteem. And then you try to do it for somebody that you don't know, and then you try to do it for somebody you hate. And that is the essence of the practice. Now, trying to do it for somebody you hate is not so easy, right? When the day you can do that spontaneously, you're well on the way to being a bodhisattva. But this is the essence of the practice. So part of it is this learning to sort of get over your instinctual attachments. And the other part is taking your instinctual attachments and just melting them like butter, right? So that they spread out and cover everything. So this is just what we do. I would be happy to send these slides to anybody that's interested. I'm not going to go through all the specific techniques tonight, but basically, in 6 weeks, we introduce people to this. So we studied. So let's go back to dry studies for a second, and then we'll be done. So what do? We took a bunch of college students. Why do we take college students? Because we can take college students, right? We have a lot of the guy that ran this hateful, everybody hates his PE class at Emory, everybody has to take it. And the guy's this great guy, and he's interested in meditation. So he said, come on in. So what it allowed us to do was to take a whole bunch of students, in this case about 65, that wanted to learn meditation, and we flipped a coin. Half of them got meditation, and half of them were put into this health discussion group, so that at least we didn't put them on a wait list, right? At least we had to meet with people, at least we tried to give them some education. 6 weeks of that, and then we gave them that nasty stress test, okay? That's the study. And we had two hypotheses. One was that kids got just randomized. So now you see, we've gotten rid of that bias, right? Now this is a bunch of people, they all want to learn meditation, so we're not just taking the weirdos that want to learn meditation and comparing them to all the fraternity jocks, you know, who are drunk and hanging out, right? You can see there's problems there. These are all the people who want to learn meditation. Half of them are going to get it, and we think that getting it is going to lower your inflammatory responses to that stress. Okay? It's very simple. That's number one. And number two was, we thought that if you look within the meditation group, that the more you practice, the more lowering you see, right? So we were gambling that it wouldn't just be something non-specific. Okay? So what did we find? Well, so here's what we found. So now you can recognize, right? Here's the time before the stress test, here's the stress test, and here's the time after. Here's cortisol, here's that inflammatory cytokine, and here's the stress. And what's interesting was that the groups weren't really different, right? So, cortisol, no, not really different. IL-6, the people, they're numerically lower, but that's not significant. The meditation group was almost significantly less upset by the stressor. You can see how those lines are trying to separate. But, so there you go. Now I can just stop right there. So what doesn't work, right? It certainly didn't seem to work. It did not seem that just going to the meditation class did anything mystical in terms of lowering people's inflammation. But take a look at this picture. This is how many times per week people meditated during the study. So each one of these, there are a lot of them overlapping, but they're people in the study. Now, they went to two classes a week. So what this tells you is that there was a group of students who missed some of the classes. There were students, the Geshe Loeb song when he started out, sometimes Tibetan meditators said they can do it laying down, you know? So he told me they could lay down. So we had to can the laying down part. But there was something very interesting. There was a subset of students that really struggled to get into this meditation study and then refused to meditate and got really weird and hostile. You know? Reminds me of my 14-year-old stepdaughter, actually, but that's the psychiatrist in me speaking. But it's very interesting. And these are the sort of things people should study, right? Because why people would do that is extremely interesting. But it runs all the way from there to people who were studying, who were meditating, you know, twice a day. Right? So there's this really big range. So what about that second hypothesis? Did how much you practice have anything to do with your response to the stressor? And here we see this really interesting pattern, which is that the more you practiced, the lower your inflammation in response to that stressor. The more you practiced, the less upset you were in response. Right? So it looks like the more you practice, wow, maybe there's something here. But be careful, because remember I said the two groups weren't different overall. So how do you know? Maybe the people, that if you looked at the control subjects, maybe the people who practiced had lower inflammation than the people that were in the health session group. Or maybe, you know, if you get to all the trouble of going to a meditation study and then you get in the meditation group and you don't study, maybe you're an oddball. So maybe these guys, maybe it's not that meditation makes you less inflamed in response to stress. Maybe the control people would look just like this, and it's the people that don't meditate who actually have higher inflammatory responses. That's not all that inconceivable, right? Because there is something strange about refusing to meditate if you go into a meditation study. Mm-hmm. So to address this, we had one kid show up to the stress test afterwards. I was outside the door of the hospital when we did it. He comes up with this big, he had a quart of Jack Daniels with him. He was smoking a cigarette. Sets the bottle of Jack Daniels down and walks in. So we had kids that came in, stoned, you know. So this was real high school. That was a slip of the tongue. Sorry about that. This was real freshman. This was real college life. So what do we do? To look to see whether, to answer that question, we took the meditation group and divided it in half, okay? By how much they practiced. Top half, bottom half. So here is both groups. You see they're not different. But now, what if we do that? So here's the kids that didn't practice. So there's the control people, there's the people that didn't practice. And you can see that fortunately for us, they weren't really different, okay? So it wasn't that the people that didn't practice were big IL-6 losers. But what it was that the people that did practice had remarkably reduced inflammatory responses to the stressor and remarkably reduced upset, right? So here, you know, more upset. You can see that these two groups are the same, right? So what it suggested was that there was something about practice very clearly linked to the type of response to stress that other things being equal is going to promote emotional and physical health. But, and if you're with me, you know there's got to be a wrinkle. We can quit here and say, wow, you know, the more you practice, the better your stress response is, so go practice. But remember the abuse I hurled at those studies of the expert meditators, right? We know that meditation's not that easy. This is like the suffering group, right? And maybe if you're somebody who doesn't freak out under stress, you're able to tolerate sitting and practicing meditation. So maybe if we'd done a stress test first, we would have found that people with low inflammatory and distress reactions just were able to practice more. Maybe the arrow of causality goes the other way. You all understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's a little bit of both. So, now, obviously, the ideal thing to do is do a stress test beforehand and a stress test afterward, right? And that's what we're doing now. We get big, big government grant. I'm going to do 400 people, and we're going to do that. But it turns out that doing the stress test twice is a bit of a challenge, because fool me once, shame on me. You fool me twice, shame on me, right? And many people don't respond. So I had to invent something horribly diabolical, which I'm not going to tell you what it is in case you have any spies in Atlanta, to make the second stress test quite distressing to people. But I had to prove that it was quite distressing to people, so it gave me an opportunity to do two of those stress tests to people, and I did it with people who were going to learn meditation. So what it allowed us to do was, so here's what I've showed you so far. You take people, you randomize them to meditation, they get the intervention, you give them the stress test, and if they practice, they have much better responses than if they don't practice. So I took people then, and before they started the meditation, I gave them the stress test. It's a different group, but they're freshmen. They're the same age, same gender, the composition, same weight. Fortunately for us, the two different groups practice the same amount of time, which is extremely lucky. But so I gave a second group a TSST beforehand, gave them the intervention, and looked to see whether the people that practiced would have better stress. You see what I'm saying? So now I'm looking to see. So it's a cheap man's way of doing a pre and a post, okay? And this is what we found, fortunately for us. So if you look at a TSST, if you look at that stress test before their meditation training, how you respond in terms of inflammation has nothing to do with how you're going to practice afterwards. Similarly, how your cortisol responds, no different, okay? So responses to stress do not predict who's going to be a high or low time meditation practicer. On the other hand, here's what I showed you before. The people that practice meditation had much lower stress response. Not only that, actually, they had lower cortisol responses. They went up and went down very, very quickly, right? Suggesting, oh, it's me. Oh, man, that's so embarrassing. It's my wife. She forgets that I'm talking to someone. Sorry about that. I was going, that is so rude. Who is the jerk that doesn't know the silence that their phone made? It's a new phone. I haven't figured out how to silence it. That's my only excuse. Yeah, it's part of the stress. This has been quite a challenge. It's interesting. But at least I got my voice back. Thank the Buddhas. So this is kind of interesting because it suggests that the meditation practice, actually, they have an appropriate response, but they're not chewing on it for a long time afterwards. And then we can see that how upset you get by a stressor doesn't predict how much you're going to practice. But man, if you practice, you're not going to get anywhere. That's really remarkable, isn't it? I mean, it's just huge. They're not even upset coming in the door. It's very different. So there's some data from other groups just now beginning to suggest that these types of compassion practices are probably good for building up positive emotions. So there's emerging data suggests that this one type of meditation is interesting in terms of these health outcomes. Now, I'm done.